All right, so we are up to Mishnah Ches, the eighth Mishnah of the first chapter of Pirkei Avos. And again, if you have a Pirkei Avos with you, that would be better and more helpful. Although, as we have done in the past, this will be mostly outside. But we'll begin by reading the Mishnah. And again, the goal of each of these Mishnayos, as we learn them, is to have one synthesizing message to take away from each Mishnah, so that by the end, God willing, we'll have just a whole bunch of serious takeaways. So let's see what the Mishnah has to say. Continuing in what we call the Zugos, the pairs of Tanayim who I guess for lack of a better term, ruled for many years and were in leadership for many years. Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shatach kiblu mehem. So these were the next generation of these Zugos, of the Av Beis Din and the Nasi, right? The heads of the entire Jewish community. So they received the tradition, and Yehuda ben Tabai Omer. So what was Yehuda ben Tabai's contribution to the world? What did he say? Three things. Al ta'as atzmecha ke'orchei hadayanin. Don't make yourself how do you translate it? It's a very complicated language. But basically, don't play the part of like an advocate. Don't advocate for people. You should be neutral. And when you do have litigants standing before you, an unbelievable quote, right? So we just had the line that I think was last week. We spoke about the idea of judging everyone, the kaf schus, that everyone should be, you should judge everyone meritoriously. Now we say no. When it comes to judging people, when you are a judge in a court, don't judge people meritoriously. Judge people as if they are wicked. Assume that at the offset, everyone is guilty. Not innocent until proven guilty. No, everyone is guilty until proven innocent. But once they leave from your courtroom, once the judgment has been meted out, they should be before you as if people who are meritorious, meaning don't take all of the preconceived notions, take any notion that you had from them, not just the preconceived ones, but the ones that you developed over the court case, and just forget about it, throw it out the window, just don't think about it anymore. And the Mishnah concludes, right, once they have already accepted the judgment, then just view them as meritorious and you can move on with your life. Don't view them, God forbid, as wicked anymore. Then it seems like you would go back to the state of viewing them, the kaf schus, to judge them meritoriously and all the other actions in life. So there are many layers of this mission, and in particular, we'll have to try to understand what the relevance is for us, since most of us, all of us in this chat, as far as I know, are not judges. We're not judging in a courtroom. We're certainly not judging in a Beis Din. So what is our takeaway from this mission? So the Avos to Rabbi Nassan, again, I'll just read it in the English, just to move more quickly. But here's what the Avos to Rabbi Nassan says. When serving as a judge, don't act as a lawyer. How should one fulfill this? If you heard a case or a halacha in the study hall, do not rush to answer. Instead, calmly analyze why the question was raised and then render your decision fairly and objectively. What the Avos to Rabbi Nassan says is something very, very simple, but also something very, very piercing. And that is that, you know, many times in life, you'll hear people forgetting about halacha, forgetting about Judaism for a second. As we were just talking about before we turned the recorder on, and we won't talk about it anymore with the recorder on, but you know, the notion of politics and the idea that when people argue at a table or when people have a conversation back and forth, many times when people have a conversation, especially when they're debating or arguing, and especially in the world that we live in nowadays where debating skills seems to be so off in this world, you know, people will just jump to conclusions. So this guy will say one thing and then this other guy will jump all over him and say, no, here's what I think, right? And that back and forth is such an unhealthy way to view life, to view conversation, to view hopefully stimulating debates. When one has an argument with someone else, you don't just jump down their throat. You listen to them carefully and you weigh everything they say, and then you make a decision and then you say something based on that. So that's what this Mishnah is saying according to the Avos to Rabbi Nassan, that when you are having a halachic decision in particular, but I would even extend it to conversations in general in life, one should be careful, one should be slow to think about it. Don't just jump to conclusions, and after slowly thinking about it and considering it, then you will be able to object answer in a truthful way. And the truth is, you know, the best comparison that I thought about when I was reading about this is the notion of, you know, the person who comes back from yeshiva, a boy or a girl who comes back from seminary or yeshiva. Many times when it comes to matters of halacha, you know, they now have a year in Israel and under their belt, and they are very frum now. They keep all the halacha in the world. They know all the halacha in the world. That's me being sarcastic, obviously. But every time some matter comes up, they are quick to jump to answer the question because they're so fiery, they're so filled with this Torah. You know, there's actually an idea based off the Gemara in Tainus that we've been learning in our Daf weeks here. This was already 11, 12 weeks ago or so, but I think it was on Daf Dalet. The idea that when a young Torah scholar, when they begin learning Torah, they get very fiery. Why do they get very fiery and passionate about their Torah? Well, because of the fact that the Torah is considered like ish. The Torah is considered like fire, and as a result, that fire sort of fills a person's heart and soul when they begin learning Torah in a serious way. And that's what you have very often with yeshiva students, because they begin learning Torah in a very serious way when they're in their gap year in Israel. They become very fiery and they want to jump down someone's throat when they think they're saying something wrong. But that's the antithesis of what the Mishnah in Avos is saying over here. That when you hear a halachic matter, when you hear anything that you may disagree with, be very slow, be very patient, think about what the other party is saying, and then respond and then answer. Because ultimately, even though decisiveness is such a crucial aspect of life, and certainly when it comes to halacha, and especially in the world that we're living in nowadays, when we see that, thank God, our poskim have such a decisive nature to them, they were able to make the really tough decisions when it came down to it. Ultimately, even though decisiveness is an ideal at some points, the best way to make a decision is slowly to calmly think about it, be thought out about it, and then you can respond to something or someone that you disagree with. Okay, moving further, that was Rabbi Nassim makes the next following statement. And when two litigants, one poor and the other rich, come before you, don't say, how can I vindicate the poor and condemn the rich? Okay, and don't say, how can I vindicate the rich and condemn the poor? Meaning, says that was Rabbi Nassim, what does it mean when our Mishnah says that everyone has to be before us, like Rasham, that everyone should be wicked? Well, says the Avos Rabbi Nassim, don't just start seeing people in front of you and start making assumptions about them. Meaning, you see someone who comes before you in a courtroom, or just, again, not if you're not a judge, just in general in life, if you see someone in rags, or if you see someone who is dressed very nicely, don't assume that that person who's dressed nicely is really rich, and therefore you should treat them really nicely because you're afraid of them, you know, afraid of what they might do to you. And don't treat the poor person poorly, no pun intended, because of the fact that, you know, they obviously won't be able to fight back, so it's easier to pick on the underdog, and then vice versa. Don't treat the poor guy well because you feel bad for him, and don't treat the rich guy badly because, you know, this guy has everything in life. That's not something that you should do. And the reason why is because at the end of the day, when it comes to judging in a courtroom, you have to be almost like the opposite of the statement that we just said. You have to be decisive. You have to be yasher. You have to be straight and just see the world in black and white. When it comes to judging in a courtroom, you can't just have sympathy for an individual. You can't just say, oh, I feel so bad for this guy, or you can't want to condemn someone else. You have to just be honest and straight and view the world as black and white. Now, this idea sounds like a very odd concept for us in Judaism. Don't we generally believe in being compassionate and loving towards one another, especially someone who is an underdog, especially someone who has not had so much mazel in life? We like to be nice to those people. We're a nation of chesed. We're a nation of tzedakah. We like to do acts of kindness and give charity to other people. So how is it that we say that we shouldn't be more sympathetic to someone who is poor and be more maybe a little harsh on someone who seems to have it all? Well, the answer seems to be that while the truth is we should be incredibly sympathetic and caring to all who are around us, when it comes to matters of judgment, when it comes to matters of halacha, there is a black and white. And we have to reach that black and white decision, and only then are we allowed to say that, okay, maybe afterwards we can be sympathetic to them. In other words, again, when it comes to making a judgment, be black and white, but when it comes to dealing with them otherwise in life, then we should of course be sympathetic, caring, and loving. And if you know, they're a poor person, give them charity or, you know, anything like that, that is necessary. But in the courtroom, we have to view the world in black and white. To summarize this Mishnah, which is, again, not such a long Mishnah, but to summarize it, I think there are two important takeaways. One is that a person should be thought out and not jump to conclusions in life ever. And number two, realize that while most areas are usually gray and we should always be compassionate, be down the kaf schus, other people, when it comes down to it, there are times when life needs to be black and white, and there are times when there is a black and white decision. You know, you can't always just be so like a seesaw. You can't keep going back and forth. You have to make decisive decisions sometimes in life. So ultimately, one should always be yasher. What that means is that a person should be patient, calm, and collected, but also decisive when that comes down to it. Okay, Mishnah 9, the next Mishnah, the second half of this pair of zugos, Shimon ben Shetach Omer. So what did Shimon ben Shetach say? One has to be one has to do a lot of investigating when the witnesses come before him. The heavy, right, in a courtroom, the heavy is a hear b'dvarecha, and a person should be careful with their words. Shema mitocham yilamdu l'shakir. Lest someone hear those words from that person, and they will lead to falsehoods because of what they just said. So this is an interesting statement. How many statements is Shimon ben Shetach making? Is he saying three or is he saying two? Seems like he's probably saying two things. Number one, make sure you investigate your witnesses. And number two, be very careful with your words. So, the first thing you notice about what Shimon ben Shetach is saying is that it sounds a lot like a continuation of what Yehuda ben Tabai, his other, counterpart, sounds exactly like what he was saying. Yehuda ben Tabai was talking about the courtroom and how to treat everyone. So then Shimon ben Shetach also comes in with courtroom politics and courtroom law. So why is in the world is Shimon ben Shetach just continuing from what Yehuda ben Tabai is saying? Is he continuing or is he actually just giving his own objective, life wisdom? So it says the Markeves HaMishnah, one of the commentaries on Perkei Avos, that Shimon ben Shetach specifically gave these ideas because of the fact that his friend Yehuda ben Tabai gave these ideas related to judges, and since he gave ideas related to judges, Shimon ben Shetach just wanted to jump on the bandwagon and give a few more supportive ideas behind that. Now, why was Shimon ben Shetach, why did he feel so strongly about interrogating witnesses? That's such an odd thing for someone to feel very passionate about. Some people are passionate about chesed, and some people are passionate about tzedakah, some people are passionate about many other mitzvos. Why is interrogating witnesses what really got Shimon ben Shetach so excited? So the Chakiras, the Medrash Shmuel quotes the idea in the name of the Rashbam, and that is that Shimon ben Shetach was so passionate about interrogating witnesses because of a basic historical fact. What is the historical fact? Well, evidently, Shimon ben Shetach had made some enemies in the courtroom. I believe the story is that he had some witches or whatever that were in front of him, some people who would divine and do things that, again, are prohibited from the Torah, but they would do some magic and things like that, and he ruled to punish them or something, again, along those lines, and as a result, they were so mad at Shimon ben Shetach for ruling against them and for not being, in their minds, nice to them, and as a result, they conspired against Shimon ben Shetach's son. They brought false testimony before the court about Shimon ben Shetach's son. Shimon ben Shetach's son was killed, and he was stoned by the court, and only in retrospect did they find that actually these people who brought testimony against them were lying, and his son was killed. He should not have been killed. And so as a result of that, evidently Shimon ben Shetach became very passionate about making sure you really investigate the witnesses, because if you were not able to investigate the witnesses carefully, then something terrible could happen, like what happened to Shimon ben Shetach's son. Okay, what about this idea of being careful with your words, lest they lead to words of falsehood? So it's a very interesting statement, because truth be told, where would you expect this statement to be? This concern that when you speak, if you're not careful enough, then it could lead to falsehood. Anyone have any thoughts? Where might we think that actually does belong, if not here? In another mission that we learned before. Maybe this, the person that I'm talking about, or the thing that I'm thinking about, it has to do with someone who had students that didn't turn out as you might have planned.
Antigonus?
Ah, good. Okay, good. Very good. So Antigonus, as we know, as we learned previously, Antigonus had these two students, Tzadok and Baitos, who ultimately didn't understand exactly what their Rebbe said, or the words got twisted up, and because of that, it led to the two biggest apikores segments that we've had in all of Jewish history. So why is it that this Mishnah is over here? Why do we find this Mishnah of being careful with your words over here in this context? So I believe that the answer has to be that when it comes down to it, this is a statement that I think is relevant for perhaps every single Mishnah in all... I'm just going to mute. Okay. Perhaps this is a statement that's relevant for every single chapter and every single... generation, I guess you can say. And that is that although, of course, Antigonus should have had this rule maybe listed in his Mishnah, maybe it would have been more appropriate. In particular, this Mishnah, this statement of being careful with your words applies in every generation, and in particular, it belongs over here because we're talking about judging in a courtroom. We've seen and heard so many times a statement that is not given clearly or a judgment that may not be given clearly, and as a result of that unclear judgment, there's a lot of confusion that comes out of that. For example, the one thing that comes to mind on this idea that clarity of speech is so important is something that I think just happened a day or two ago in one of Governor Cuomo's press conferences. There was a headline that came from the press conference that said, it looks like something like this. It looks like we're going to be able to have shul on Shavuos. That was, I think, a headline in one of the Jewish reporting online news sources. And so you look at what Cuomo said. That's not at all what he said. What he said was that it sounds like there was an Orthodox Jew in his a reporter in the audience who asked him about it, and he said, "Okay, Cuomo basically said it's a good point, and I'm going to look into it and try to give some guidance in that area." All right, so he did not say that you will be in shul on Shavuos. Most likely, well, for sure, we will not be in shul on Shavuos. That's pretty much a given at this point, since Nassau County is not open. Now we need 14 days after phase one. Okay, fine, but not for right now. But the point is that Cuomo gave a statement that was not entirely clear, and as a result of that, they're led to all this confusion. They're led to headlines that seem to say that everything is going to be we're going to be allowed to go back into shul. And again, that's, I'm not trying to make a political statement over here, not saying pro or con about what Cuomo has done or what he has said, but it's just proving the point that clarity of words and clarity of speech and judgment when it comes to serious matters is so important. So ultimately, I would say the message from this Mishnah is a fewfold. That one has to be so careful in life, meaning what does it mean that a person should be so careful in life? That some people are so overconfident. And you know what overconfidence does? It causes people to make mistakes, right? When someone is all up on their high horse and they say, "I know everything," then that will ultimately lead to mistakes. So a person should allow themselves to take the time that one needs to make sure that the witnesses are honest, not rushing to conclusions, assuming that they're totally right, and make sure that you, as a judge, or as an individual, a regular person in the world, are speaking in a way that is clearly and that everyone will understand. And in general, if one could do this, if they can take their time, if they could be patient and thorough in all matters in life, then we'll be the better for it. Okay, Mishnah Yud. So Mishnah Yud brings us to the exciting world of Shemaya and Avtalion. Shemaya and Avtalion, I would say, are probably some of the most famous Tanayim that we have, particularly because of their background, which we'll talk about in just a moment. So let's break into it. Mishnah Yud, the 10th Mishnah. Shemaya v'Avtalion kiblu mehem. Right, so the next group of Zugim, the next group of the Nasi and the Av Beis Din accepted the next generation of tradition. Shemaya Omer, so what did Shemaya say? Ehov es hamalacha, usnei es harabanus, ve'al tesvadal harishus. One should love work, one should hate positions of leadership, and one should not form a good relationship with people in the government. Okay, so before we begin to break into what seem to be very earth-shattering statements, each of them in their own right is a very powerful idea that we'll have to look into and understand a little bit better. But let's understand who Shemaya and Avtalion were. Shemaya and Avtalion probably have one of the most confused backgrounds of all the Tanayim, and that is, were Shemaya and Avtalion Jewish, right? So obviously, when they taught these statements, they were Jewish. That's without question, right? Their place in the Mishnah places them as the Nasi and the Av Beis Din. But the question that everyone asks is, were they converts, right? And so that's just a historical question: were they or were they not converts? So the Bartanura on the side, one of the main commentaries of Mishnayos, says that yes, they were converts. That Shemaya and Avtalion themselves became passionate about Judaism, and as a result, they converted to Judaism at whatever age they decided to convert. The Tosfos Yom Tov, however, and others say, no, that's not the case. It doesn't make sense if Shemaya and Avtalion were converted themselves in their own lifetime. Why doesn't it make sense if they converted in their own lifetime? Because we know we have an important rule, an important halacha that could be found in the Rambam and in other places that says that converts, as much as we have to love them and have this obligation to care for them and look after them, nonetheless, converts are not allowed to have positions of leadership in the Jewish community. Right? Very famously, there's an idea that a convert, in theory, is not allowed to be the rabbi of a shul, or a convert is not allowed, certainly not allowed to be a judge in a beis din. And the reason why is because it's based off of a pasuk that says that we should not have anyone who is in a position of leadership unless they are born Jewish. Okay, it's a fascinating philosophical question. Again, not for right now, but that is the basic halacha that the Rambam brings down. So it says the Tosfos Yom Tov, if that's the case, that a convert is not allowed to have a position of leadership, how do you have Shemaya and Avtalion being the leaders of the generation, right? Each generation, each pair represents the leaders of that Jewish generation. So how do we have these two converts be the leaders? So says the Tosfos Yom Tov, as a result, and they themselves were not converts, right? They were born Jewish, their mother was Jewish. Who was a convert? Their father was a convert. In the world that we live in nowadays, I'd say probably in some communities it is a very big deal, right? But certainly in those days, if you want to be the leader of a community, to say that your father is a convert, that was a pretty big deal. So, you know, people, I guess rumors were spread or things were said about them that probably should not have been said. But the point is that this name became known about them, that they were either converts or of descent of a convert, which again became a big deal. But so that's what the Tosfos Gemara says, that they were not converts, but that their father was a convert. Now, how would you answer for the Bar Tanura? We like the Bar Tanura. We like all of them, Mefarshim on the Mishnah, but in particular, we like the Bar Tanura because he's one of the most well-known commentators. He's on the side of most of the Mishnayos. So how do we answer for the Bar Tanura, who says that yes, they were converts, and meaning, because the big question against him is, if they were converts, how are they able to hold these positions of leadership? So what others argue, the Magi Nevos and others say, it's very simple. We say that a convert is not allowed to have a position of leadership if they are like everyone else. Meaning a convert who is either a Joe Schmo, or maybe not even just a Joe Schmo, but they could be huge Talmidei Chachamim. If we have someone who was born of Jewish descent, then, and they're equals, then they are not allowed to be in a position of leadership. However, if they are the greatest of their generation, which Shemaiah and Avtalion were heads above everyone else, as a result, since they were, then they are allowed to be leaders, even though, again, they might have themselves been converts. But okay, that was just a technical point. Let's move forward a little bit. Let's try to understand what some of the teachings of this Mishnah is all about. The first idea of loving work, Ehovas HaMalacha, that one should love the work. So the idea of loving work is a very critically important one. Number one, because it is a clear sign of hashkafic differences between various Orthodox communities. We know that certainly in the modern Orthodox community, I don't know if the word is idealized, but we certainly prioritize the notion that everyone should have a job, everyone should be working, everyone should be spending their life making a real contribution to the world. So how is it that we view the notion of work? Well, the Mishnah in Avos is very clear. One should love work. How do other communities deal with that? Those communities in particular that are not spending their time working, maybe a community that, I don't want to give any specifics, but you know what I'm talking about. There are some communities who may not be working all day long. That's not their priority, for whatever reason. So how do we view that? It seems to be antithetical to the Mishnah. How do they justify it? Okay, so that's it. I gave a talk on that earlier this year, I think, of how we view the Kollel system and things like that. But nonetheless, that seems to not be what the Mishnah is so in favor of. We should love work. So what does the Avos Rabbi Nassan say about this? A very powerful idea. The Avos Rabbi Nassan gives a few beautiful examples that really bring the point home. Number one, it says that why is work such a value to us? Well, because just as the Torah was given in a covenant, so work was given in a covenant. As it says, for 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, and the seventh day is Shabbos. A very simple idea, says the Avos Rabbi Nassan. We are commanded to do work. How do we know that we're commanded to do work? Because the Torah says you have to keep Shabbos. Well, what is Shabbos supposed to be? Shabbos is supposed to be a rest from work. You can't rest from work unless you're doing work. That must mean that we're obligated to be working in our lives. So therefore, working is very important. A few beautiful statements from some of the Tanaim in the Avos Rabbi Nassan. Rabbi Akiva would say, sometimes a person labors and escapes death, and sometimes a person does not labor and becomes liable for death. How so? I'll say the example outside because it's a little complicated. He gives the example of someone who works in the Beis HaMikdash. Someone who works for the Beis HaMikdash is paid with Beis HaMikdash funds. Now, in general, the funds that are in the Beis HaMikdash are in theory considered holy, but since they are given for someone else's work, they lose their holiness level, and they then can be used for secular matters. They can be used for a person to buy food for themselves and the like. However, says Rabbi Akiva, you could have someone who says they're very holy. How holy are they? Well, they don't work at all, and they don't have any money except for the money that they decide to dedicate to the Beis HaMikdash. And so, what are they going to do at the end of the week? They're going to find themselves so hungry because they don't have any money that they made from working. They a little bit of money that they had, they just decided to dedicate to holy matters. But what's going to happen? They're starving now, so what are they going to eat? They're going to have to use the money that they sanctified for the Beis HaMikdash. So that person is going to end up not working, using the Beis HaMikdash funds for inappropriate reasons, and therefore being liable to death as a result, whereas someone else can use the Beis HaMikdash funds if he worked for them in the Beis HaMikdash. That's how some people will work and escape death, and some people will not work and therefore be liable for death. A few more beautiful stories, Rabbi Dos, or statements, Rabbi Dos Stuy Chai would say, how do we know that if someone did not work all 6 days, that he will end up doing work on the seventh? Meaning he's saying, how do we know that if someone is not working properly during the week between Sunday and Friday, that someone is going to end up working on Shabbos? Well, very simple. For see, if he sat all the days of the week and didn't work, and then on the eve of the Shabbos, he had nothing to eat, he would then go out looking, right? Very simple, right? A basic math equation says that if a person didn't earn any money between Sunday and Friday, now all of a sudden, of course, they're at Tzadik, they're going to buy food for Shabbos. Oh no, I don't have any money to buy food for Shabbos. What do I have to do? I'm going to have to work on Shabbos to get my money to buy food on Shabbos. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar would say, even Adam HaRishon did not taste anything until he worked. Right, the pasuk says very famously that first Adam HaRishon had to work the land, and only then was he able to receive food. And then finally, Rabbi Tarfon would say that even Hashem did not rest his presence among the Jewish people until they had done work. What an unbelievable idea. Hashem will not rest his Shechina, his presence on us, unless we do work. Where do you see that, says Rabbi Tarfon? Because of the pasuk of the Asu Li Mikdash V'Shachanti B'Tocham. First is Hashem, you have to build the Mishkan. You have to do physical labor, and only then will I decide to rest among you. What we see from here is not that work is so valued, but almost that working, allowing ourselves to spend Sunday through Friday working in life, is a preparation for holiness. How is it that working will prepare us for holiness? Well, I think it's a very simple equation when you think about it. When we work very hard, we know that we will earn money. As a result of earning money, we will obviously then be enabled to spend money on beautiful holy matters. But not just that, we also learn the idea of how to attain holiness. Right? It's an example that I've given many times before, that people go into davening, and many people struggle with kavana in davening, and many people struggle not always being able to learn so much. There are many things that people struggle with in Judaism, and they're almost angry, sometimes maybe even angry at God, or maybe angry at themselves, maybe angry at rabbis, who knows? A lot of people could have anger when it comes to these matters. Right? Why do people get angry about these things? Because they're furious. Why is it not just so easy for me to just jump in and daven? How come davening doesn't come natural? How come learning Torah doesn't come natural to me? Says the Mishnah over here, so simple. Why does learning not come natural? Because nothing in life is meant to be given to you naturally. Just like you have to work Sunday through Friday and you have to work hard to earn money, so too that will prepare you for holiness, meaning that you'll learn that you have to work to attain holiness. How does davening become easy, or how does davening become easier, I guess you could say? How does learning become easier? How does attaining holiness become easier? You work for it. If you work for it, what you learned because you had to work during the week, so now if you work to attain holiness, you will be able to attain holiness. A third point is not just that you have to work and love work, but even if you don't have work, says the Avos Rabbi Nassan, you should still work. Meaning, make work for yourself. Rabbi Huda ben Beseder would say, if someone who has no work to do, what should he do? He should find a dilapidated field somewhere, and he should go and work on that field. Meaning, even a field that you never thought of working on because it's so useless, and if you have nothing else to do, do work there. Because we value work so much. What's his source? From the pasuk we just said a second ago. 6 days you shall labor and do all of your work. What do we learn, says Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseir, from the phrase of do all of your work? That even someone who has dilapidated yards or fields should work on them. Right? So this idea is so powerful that one should never stop working in their life. What this shows us is the notion that retirement, right, that a person should get to a certain age and no longer work at all and just spend the rest of their days, I don't want to insult anyone, but someone should never spend the rest of their days vacationing, you know, to all the islands of the world for the rest of their life. That's not a Jewish value. A Jewish value is that one should never retire. One should always work. Now that, let me qualify that, that does not mean that a person has to spend the rest of their life working Sunday through Friday, 6 days a week, 24 hours a day. What that means is that as a person gets older, they can limit their work. Right, I'll tell you a very quick story. Someone who is a very, very special older man, I heard it not through him directly, but through someone else. He said that he told this younger gentleman that one should never be retiring in this world. What does that mean? So if you start off working 5 days, then and you can't do that anymore as you get older, work 4 days. You can't work four, work three. You can't work three, work two. And if you can't work two, you work one. If you can't work one day, work an hour a day at least, just to keep working. Why, he said, this is not my words, the advice of a very elderly, special gentleman. He said, because retiring, it causes you to slow down. Working is what allows your mind to stay stimulated, what allows you to keep going in this world. If you are no longer working, you're basically telling God that I don't want to do anything else in this world. I don't care about anything. I don't care about making a contribution to the world. Now, let me qualify that one step further. That does not mean that a person is not allowed to retire from their specific job. What it means is that a person should constantly view themselves as contributing to this world in some functional way. So again, most of us do that most of our lives through having a real 9-to-5 job or something like that. But even once we get to a point where we say we no longer want to do that job anymore, which is legitimate, you don't have to do your busy, crazy job for your entire life until the day, until 120, but rather you should view every day of your life as a way to add something to this world. That's what it means to love work. When you say love work, you have to be adding something to this world every single day of your life until 120. Okay, one more idea, two more ideas, I should say. Despising positions of leadership. Why do we have to despise positions of leadership? Well, the notion seems to be obvious, and that is that if a person spends their entire life trying to run after kavod, trying to run after honor, then ultimately the famous idea is that the honor will run away from them. One should not be so obsessed with titles and trying to get the highest position of leadership. One should try to do good in the world, and naturally, in doing good, they will be elevated to positions of leadership. Rabbi Akiva, who made a specific statement about this, in the Avos de Rabbi Nassan, he himself said that a person should never promote oneself. Rabbi Akiva is the perfect person to serve as the paradigm for not running after kavod, because we know very famously that Rabbi Akiva, not only did he become great very late in life, and that was something that the greatness ultimately chased him when he had worked hard enough to achieve it, but also that Rabbi Akiva was always said, the famous statements that Rabbi Akiva made, that he used to hate rabbis. Rabbi Akiva never liked rabbis. Why didn't he like rabbis? Well, it's not explained explicitly, but perhaps one of the reasons why he didn't like rabbis is because he had always perceived some rabbis, again, whether or not this was true is not the point, but he had always perceived perhaps rabbis as running after kavod. Again, likely with the great rabbis, that certainly was not the case, but that's how he perceived them, and that's why he didn't like them. Rabbi Akiva was never the one to run after greatness or run after leadership, and ultimately, if one does not run after positions of leadership, those positions of leadership will follow them. Finally, this last idea, and with this we'll conclude, is the idea of not developing a close relationship with the government, right? The Mishnah says explicitly, don't get close to the political officials. Why should a person not get close to political officials? Well, it seems like according to the Mefarshim in particular, the Ri Nachmiash, one of the other Mefarshim in Avos, explains that when it comes down to it, back in the day, no one should have been close to politicians, because politicians were always looking to do bad things for the Jews. They, if you got too close to them, they would see something in you, and they would, you know, maybe bring a court case against you, and perhaps something terrible would happen with you. That's how politicians used to function. How do politicians function nowadays? Well, maybe not so different, but a little different, to the extent that if you form a good enough relationship with a politician, right? We know the concept of lobbying, certainly in the great states of the great United States of America. If you form a good enough relationship with them, then by doing so, you will actually be able to hopefully have positive things come to your community. And therefore, as a result, says the Ri Nachmiash, that this is something that does not apply nowadays. Back in the day, we did not want to get close to political leaders because it was just a danger to do that. Nowadays, it will only help us, for the most part, to have a good relationship with political leaders. Again, maybe don't learn from all their actions, because a lot of them are not so yashar and straight in this world, but to form a good enough relationship with them to be able to forward your cause and forward the goodness of the community that you're representing, aka the Jewish community. Ultimately, the message from this Mishnah is what I would say, is to sum it up in four words, is that Judaism believes in action. We don't just sit around and do nothing in Judaism. We believe in being active and contributing to the world, and not to always worry about the formalities. Oh, you know, maybe I wasn't given the most kavod, maybe I wasn't given that award, just to always do, always constantly be serving others in your community, and through doing that, you will ultimately find yourself in having added so much to the world, and in particular, learned what it means to be in this world, and that is that learning going way back to Adam Harishon, who was someone who had to contribute into this world, who had to work the field from day one to get anything, so too that's how we should view ourselves, that we should have, even though we don't have to, thank God, work the field, the food comes right to our grocery stores, we have to still continue to contribute and work in our own ways, and God willing, through doing that, we will be the better for it, and our communities and the world will be the better for it. Everyone should have a great day.